Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
All right, I'm going to open up this can.
Okay.
You like it, a juice?
You like it? No. No, I didn't.
You know who did like the juice? David Carradine.
Okay. You thought
he loved
he was
him
drunk.
Some juice.
I don't think he was drunk. I just thought he was really nervous. At least that's what it seemed to me.
The rumor is that he was wasted. That's not just me thinking that. That's SNL lore, is that he was on something when he was hosting this episode of Saturday Night Live.
Well, first off, welcome to Saturday Night Drive, everybody. I'm Ben. This is George. We're on Skype again. We're social distancing still. We watched an episode of Saturday Night Live because we like to ask ourselves, why do we even do this anymore?
Yeah. Well, we pulled out Gail Mathias's name out of our makeshift hat. And since she's not in any movies, we watched an episode from her brief SNL tenure. This is Season 6, Episode 5, hosted by David Carradine, and musical guest, the cast of the Pirates of Penzance.
Fuck this musical guest more than any other fucking musical guest. Captain Beefheart, I miss you so much.
I gotta say, though, like, it was interesting. It wasn't good.
I got a minute in, and I'm just like, fuck it.
Oh, I watched the whole thing. It wasn't good, but it was interesting. Like, they've never done that before and since. Like, you would imagine, like, SNL is on in New York City. Like, why hasn't the cast of Hamilton shown up and been the musical guest for SNL?
Because I would have enjoyed that, and fuck if this show is ever going to do anything I enjoy.
That's true. That would require someone to, you know, have a good idea behind the scenes of Saturday Night Live. Which was not happening in Season 6. Season 6 is notoriously the worst season of Saturday Night Live, for good reason. But before we get into it, just want to ask you, better or worse than Malcolm McDowell?
It's. I wouldn't say it's as bad as Malcolm McDowell, and it's probably more interesting. It's maybe the weirdest one, even compared to, I would say, Mr. T and Hulk Hogan. This is probably the weirdest episode I think we've watched.
Yeah, but I would say it's marginally, like, leaps and bounds better than the Malcolm McDowell episode. And that was episode 2 of the season. This is episode 5. And also, just weird to watch this for Eddie Murphy, because wasn't even on in the cast in episode 2. Episode 3, he has a brief weekend update bit, like, with Joe Piscopo. Like, he was just basically an unnamed extra. They brought him on for one line. His fourth episode, he has his own solo weekend update bit, which, like, kills with the audience. And then this is episode 5. He's the star of the show already.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, when his sketch, the fashion sketch, like, I'm watching that going, like, was this a recurring character that he had? Like, did he do this with a bunch of... But, I mean, obviously it was the first one, if it was.
Yeah, no, this is his, like, basically his first, like, real episode. And, yeah, he kills it. He's, like, the fucking best part of this stupid-ass show.
The Malcolm McDowell episode is more memorable because of how bad it is.
Oh,
the
yeah.
problem with this episode is a lot of it's just kind of mediocre. So, like, I don't think I'm going to remember this as, oh, well, at least it was better than that. I think just because the other one affected me more, you know?
Yeah. And this one is a little boring, and it's boring to start. I will say I watched this in two chunks. I started watching it last night, and I got so fucking bored.
Woody Guthrie sketch, my God.
I was like, I can't watch this anymore. And then I watched the back half just now, and it breezed by. I was like, oh, the back half of this episode is not bad, except for the last sketch, which was like, what? Whoa, David Carradine doesn't know where the hell he is.
Can I throw out one weird non sequitur, though, first?
Sure.
I'm just thinking about it because this is yet another horribly, indefensibly racist episode of SNL, which at this point, it's like, when is it not going to be racist? I also think my phone is racist because we were texting when you were having some troubles getting connected to Skype, and I wrote weird, and my phone suggested the next word should be Jewish. So And I've never texted weird Jewish anything, so it's not like they learned that from me. So I think my phone is anti-Semitic.
I'm trying to think, like, what that would be in reference to, like, if we ever texted about a movie and put weird Jewish.
I don't know, but it's just, it just kind of concerned me a little bit, especially after watching Gilbert Gottfried as the fucking...
I don't know if I'd call that racist.
Dude, this is not the hill you want to die on, man. Everybody's going to look for this clip. You're going to put it in the episode, and everybody's going to go, what the fuck is he talking about?
When you said this was racist, my mind jumped to another section of the show. I wasn't even thinking about Gilbert Gottfried in Yellowface.
Were you thinking of he's Bruce Lee and he's back and he's black?
Yeah, that was the best part. I love that. No, I was more thinking about the last sketch. It wasn't outright racist, but I was like, really? The only, you know, female black cast member you've ever had, the first part you give her in her first episode is she's applying for welfare?
Well, we'll get to that sketch.
That's what you think to do with her?
I actually have a marginal defense of that sketch, but and also there was a joke in the Weekend Update that I the only way I get it is if it's racist, when he says that Reagan is going to be the president of Japan.
Well, because that's a photo joke. The joke was of Reagan, like, it looked like he was in mid-sneeze, so his eyes were like all squinty.
So that is the joke. Okay, so that's a fucking racist joke, right?
Oh, yes. It was a picture of Reagan with his eyes, like, squinted. So they're like, they were doing a Chinese-Japanese dirty knees, look at these joke.
I was trying to give it the benefit of the doubt that maybe I just didn't get it and it was something else, or, like, something referring to something I just didn't know. But, like, no, that's just, it's just a fucking racist anti-Asian joke.
Nope. Yep, that's the joke. That is absolutely the joke. All right. So we start this episode with a little backstage from Joe Piscopo, our good old buddy Joe Piscopo, who is warming up to try to replace Don Pardo as the announcer because he wants, I guess, double the paycheck.
Hotel accommodations for most guests of Saturday Night Live were furnished by
Joe, all Joe.
Don? Don, are you there?
I'm everywhere, Joe.
Sorry, Don. I was just trying to...
Yeah, I know what you were up to, Joe. Now you behave yourself.
Okay.
I mean, I don't blame Piscopo for this. I still like him, but I thought this was kind of lame. Awesome. I mean, I feel like it could have turned into something else and didn't.
Oh, yeah. This smacks of they had nothing else this week, so they were like, let's do this maybe, because it's less than a minute long for a cold open.
Yeah, it feels like he just did his Don Pardo impression and somebody said, hey, let's put that in,
which is surprisingly weak.
I mean, I can't do any impressions, but I feel like that's an easy impression. It's a very broad kind of almost caricature voice.
Yeah, and Piscopo is kind of known for impressions. Well, I mean, I guess not at this time. It's just his fifth episode. But yeah, I was surprised by how kind of weak his Don Pardo impression was. But anyway, like I said, it's 45 seconds for a cold open. He says live from New York at the end. And then did you like his little look to the camera?
Yeah, he like tilts his head and goes, did you like that? No, I didn't.
Because the camera just stays on his face after he says live from New York. And he just gives a look like, I'm a bad little boy.
Well, he did that twice in this episode, because in the gun sketch, when it freezes on his face, the look is just so weird. Like, what was he thinking there? I don't understand it.
He's probably thinking, when is this camera going to be off of me?
But I wonder if it was on purpose. I wonder if he knew that it was dumb and just like, I'm just going to do this because fuck him.
Oh, maybe. I would love to just have a book about this season. I mean, they cover this season in the Live from New York book, but I want like a whole book, like with everybody's stories, like on every single episode. Like, what the fuck was going through your mind when you were writing the commie hunting sketch for the Malcolm McDowell episode, when you were rehearsing it?
And I'm still fascinated by just the virulent anti-Reagan stuff. I'm not surprised that that's their stance, but like, they still seem like shell-shocked by the Reagan election. Like, the whole Weekend Update thing was like, you know, just like, fuck him, he should resign. That's the only way he could make the country better. Like, that was the last joke, and it's
that
just
was
like,
that was a damn good joke. I love that.
Yeah,
I
but
actually
it just,
liked Weekend Update for this episode.
I know. I would say it's certainly much better than the last Charles Rocket one we watched.
Oh my god, yes.
But it feels like they're kind of off their game a bit because of that. Like they don't understand what the country is, you know, while they're writing jokes about it, you know?
Well, I had never thought about that before, but like, you know, because I didn't live through the 1980 election. I wasn't born yet, but it had to have been a little similar to 2016. Like, I remember when Donald Trump was elected our president, I was like, what the fuck are we doing as a country? And I'm sure there were so many people who were like, the guy in Bedtime for Bonzo is our fucking president now?
Well, but I think that the thing is, though, like, the modern version of SNL dealing with that same problem were at least self-aware enough. Like, I think the first sketch afterwards was the Chappelle one where they, like, the black people were like, look at all these white people being surprised by Trump. Like, they kind of understood that this was a crazy moment. Whereas I don't think this cast really, like, they don't even understand how to grapple with it.
Yeah, well, this era was not huge on political humor. They didn't really get into much political humor until like the George H.W. Bush years. I mean, they would always had Weekend Update, which was kind of political, but I mean, it wasn't in the era after this, the Dick Ebersol era, they shied away from politics completely. Like they barely did any kind of Reagan sketches or anything.
Well, I mean, I know we're jumping around a lot, but cause I'm curious. Cause I think today Joe Piscopo is, I think he's kind of a conservative. He might even be a Trumper. And I'm just thinking of the gun sketch again, which is a very kind of Libby anti-gun premise, I think, anyway. That, I mean, it's barely satire at this point. But I'm curious if, like, even then, maybe he was more liberal then, or maybe it was just a bit and he didn't care. But it's just when it is political, it does seem weird in this era.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. So let's go into the monologue of David Carradine. You don't think he's drunk here?
Well, because he's talking so fast. And at one point, he even fucking says, I'm just reading the cards here.
Because he name drops Kung Fu and he's like, yeah, I was on Kung Fu. And then the audience cheers and he's like, just reading the cards.
And this... I mean, we'll get to it obviously when we get to the sketches, but like the multiple Kung Fu sketches, I can't think of another time where, like, because, you know, the host comes in and he's obviously known for something, but like nowadays, like if Chris Evans hosted, he mentions Captain America in the monologue, but you're not going to have a Captain America sketch, or if you do, you have one and
you're
it's got to be
three of them.
You're not going to have the whole sketch where like one cast member's whole job is to fucking play the Red Skull.
I don't know. And we'll, like, we could talk about it when we get to the Kung Fu sketches, but this episode was named in the Live from New York book by Gilbert Gottfried. He basically said, like, I spent the whole episode dressed as Master Po from Kung Fu. That's all they gave me to do on the show. This was kind of when I realized this isn't a good gig.
Well, did you see him? Because he's like standing next to David Carradine in the Good Nights, and it almost feels like it's like a consolation. Like, yeah, sorry, yeah, buddy, I know we made you do that. And he's like kind of sheepish. Like you can feel that.
Because you didn't see his face the whole episode. He plays Master Po in three sketches, but he's in such heavy makeup and they cover up his eyes so he looks Asian that if you were just a cat, you wouldn't know that was Gilbert Gottfried. I mean, if I didn't know that was Gilbert Godfrey, I might not have known.
I knew it from his voice, and because he's the only thing I laughed at in the episode.
Yeah, but then at the end, I think they put him right there, and he's still in the costume, not in the makeup. I think that was just basically like, see, this guy was in the show this week. He was the guy playing the Asian stereotype.
There's the new Belushi right there.
But yeah, there we go. So David Carradine's monologue, because he also has a moment where he goes, he says something. I can't remember the joke, but then he just flat out goes, well, that didn't work. Just keeps moving on.
When I was young, I wanted to do this one thing very badly. And of course, my father did not want me to do it. I remember him telling me, no son of mine is going to make his living with his feet. Well, anyway, that didn't work. So... Well, you know, I did get to use my feet a lot in Kung Fu, but my urge still was not being satisfied. I'm just reading the card. That's all I'm doing.
And they laughed at that. They laughed at him pointing out that they didn't laugh.
Yeah, I don't even remember the joke. I just remember him going, yep, that didn't work.
I couldn't hear the joke because he was so, like, stumbling and fumbling over his lines.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't the joke's fault. Like I said, I'm pretty sure he's drunk. But, yeah, then this monologue, he just starts dancing, and I had no idea what the fuck was going on. And then Charlie Rocket shows up, David Carradine gives him a kick, and forces him off the stage. That's the end of the monologue.
Well, and the thing I wrote down with this is sand dancing a thing? Because, like, he's throwing sand on the floor, and, like, I feel like that's, like, if you can't tap dance well, like, you can kind of shuffle around, and it doesn't seem like you're as bad. Like, is that the thing?
Is that a Kung Fu reference?
I never watched Kung Fu, so I don't know. I watched the one in the 90s, the Return or whatever, but no, I wouldn't know.
Yeah, I was confused by that, too, because he pulls sand out of his pocket and then dances on the sand. But then later on, in one of the Kung Fu sketches, he, like, pulls sand out of his pocket. It's in the Taylor sketch, like, when he's about to tear up the place, he pulls sand out of his pocket. So I thought that was, like, something from Kung Fu.
That's possible. I didn't even think of that, but yeah, they do that again. So that probably is.
Yeah, and then he starts dancing on the sand.
Just that we have to fucking figure out the puzzle of this just to get the context for this old shit that we don't care about.
I mean, that's not all Saturday Night Live's fault.
No.
We're 40 years removed from this episode, and this episode is, you know, probably 10 years removed from Kung Fu.
That's the thing. I'm a huge South Park fan. If you watch a South Park episode from like 5 years ago, you'd be lost because it's just so esoteric with, well, now, you know, it's at the time it was relevant and now who gives a fuck?
Yeah. Oh, wait, no, you don't remember. In 1980, this was a thing. Brenda Vaccaro was a tampon spokeswoman. Now you can understand that Brenda Vaccaro joke from Weekend Update.
I want to get to that because I did actually like the Weekend Update segment this time. Both of them, actually.
I was surprised that I liked Weekend Update. Weekend Update is deadly in this era, especially Charlie Rocket, but I was surprised. So after the monologue, we get Joe Piscopo just screaming about guns.
And Gun City has all the bullets you'll ever need. These shells make great stocking stuffers. At Gun City, we sell to anyone. Permits? Ha ha! We'll take care of them. We don't care about your past, only your future. So come on down, arm your loved ones, and put a bang in their life at Gun City.
I would have liked this, except you watch it today, and it doesn't feel like satire. Like, I can imagine this commercial existing today.
Right.
Unironically. Yeah.
Basically, this is Joe Piscopo's, like, Crazy Eddie-type character, where he just shouts, you know, we got this, we got this, we got this, and our prices are insane! But this is a commercial for Gun City, so he's telling, you know, we get guns for the whole family, little guns for the kids, and bullets, we got bullets. Daddy gets a big gun, mommy gets a little gun.
Permits? Ha-ha!
Right. They don't care who buys them. Just come in, get a gun, and run around New York City with it.
Post-Reagan 80s, this feels like really cogent satire. This feels like the gun nuts are taking over. This is a commercial that would exist in the Reagan era in the satirical version of it. But now it's just like, no, we've just evolved to this point.
Yeah, no, this looks like, yeah, you might see this late at night on, you know, your local cable channel. Some guy going, come in and get a gun, and don't worry. Don't worry if you ain't got a license.
But yeah, this is the one where at the end it doesn't freeze frame. Did they not have the technology for freeze frame? Could you not do that on live TV?
I'm sure they could have, but yeah, you do see that a lot in these old episodes of SNL. People will just freeze, like, at the end of sketches. But, like, they're doing it live, so they're just, like, standing there and not talking.
Say, hey, my man, for what can I do you?
I have wandered far. My thirst is great. I seek water.
Water? Wanda? Man, you wouldn't have no trouble trying to find something to drink if you were dressed right.
Kane from Kung Fu walks into a tailor shop, and Eddie Murphy is the tailor.
And you mentioned Eddie Murphy, like, he's the star of the show because he has, like, these long sketches like this. But fuck, this sketch was shit. There was nothing here.
Well, I mean, yes, there was absolutely nothing here.
What's the joke in this sketch?
See, and that's what I find interesting about it, is there doesn't seem to be a concept here. Kane walks into a tailor shop, and then the tailor tries to sell Kane a suit. I mean, this one's definitely hampered by David Carradine just being lost.
Did you catch when he looked into the camera? In order to look at the, I don't know if maybe they, like, I remember when Christopher Walken would look at the cue cards, he would always look off screen, like to the side.
Yeah.
Which is where I assume they are. He looks directly at the camera. So did they have the cue cards like right below the camera then, maybe?
They might have. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's where they had him for Joe Piscopo. So maybe they were just in the same place because Joe Piscopo is looking straight at the camera for Gun City. So the cue cards are probably right underneath. But no, there is one point in this where David Carradine like just shrugs his shoulders and is like, I don't know. Fucking gives up.
It felt like he definitely missed a line and like Eddie Murphy's just sort of standing there. And I don't think Eddie Murphy's prepared enough as a performer because, like I said, this is his first big episode that I don't think he knows necessarily to cover right away. Like, so there's like a moment where he's just like, well, wait, what do we do? You're supposed to say something.
Yeah, but I think he's doing his best. Like, I think this is where Eddie Murphy was like, I'm in a sketch that is not funny. I'm going to do everything I can to make it funny. And he just kind of makes this into an Eddie Murphy character sketch, which I doubt it was that. I mean, like we said, this is his first major episode. They're not writing Eddie Murphy into the first sketch of the night as like, hey, this will be an Eddie Murphy sketch. He's just taking over. He's like, I'm going to do the best thing I can do to make this fucking sketch all about me.
Well, that's the thing. If you told me that this was his third time doing this character on this show, I would believe you. It feels very lived in.
Oh, yeah. It feels very formed. And it was funny for me because at one point, David Carradine is looking in the mirror, and that's when you see Gilbert Godfrey as Master Poe with his fucking Asian eyes. But Eddie Murphy can't hear Master Poe. So he's just like standing off in the corner going, who you calling Grasshopper?
Not seduced by the allure of fine menswear, Grasshopper, for with each season fashions change. Trust not your fate to gay Italians, Grasshopper.
Master, I wish to ask you one more thing.
Go ahead, brother, I'm all ears.
Why do you call me Grasshopper?
Who called you Grasshopper?
I just wrote this line down. Trust not your fate to gay Italians. That's Master Poe's advice to Kung Fu.
I don't get this at all. Yeah, nothing written in this sketch is funny. I liked this sketch specifically because of Eddie Murphy. And then I also liked it for the wrong reasons. At the end of the sketch when like there's just a weird music sting and then both David and Eddie just like kind of look lost for a second. And then nobody says anything. And then David Carradine's like, I'm going to destroy your store now.
I thought you was a player.
I am a wanderer. My name is Kane.
They used to call me Grasshopper.
Oh, yeah?
Well, now I must destroy your store.
Said what?
See, I took as a Kung Fu reference that I just didn't get.
Which, the music sting?
The music, well, the whole bit, yeah, the music sting, and like, I don't know if maybe that's just something that happened at the end of every Kung Fu episode or what, I don't know.
Yeah, I think the music sting was ill-timed and then it threw him off even more than he was already thrown off just by being there in the first place. But then he destroys the store in slow motion while Eddie Murphy is just calling the cops going, oh, there's this weird-ass white dude messing up my store. So that part was funny.
I think it would just went on too long. I think the sketch could have stood to be like half as long as it was.
Oh, it did. It's bad. It's not good. But at least I think this one is interesting and entertaining enough as kind of an artifact. The next
especially compared to the next sketch
is not interesting or entertaining. And I have absolutely no notes on it. So is there anything
girls...
you have to say about it?
Well, there is one thing which is, well, one, I guessed. I put in my notes, will there be a larger premise to this? No.
I am this bored city of 1980. What time is it?
Well, it's 2 now. I mean, we've already been here 4 hours, but my mother's not picking us up till 5:30.
My God! We've done everything there is to do at this stupid mall. God, I'm bored to the max.
We could go back to Hutton's and try on the makeup at the counter.
No, gone way. I was just in there and I was trying on some eyeshadow, you know, and stuff. And the lady comes up to me and goes, "May I help you?" Rude city. I told her to bite the bag and left.
Was that ever a real thing outside of movies and TV shows, the Valley Girl thing? Were there actual Valley Girls that talked like this?
It would have had to have been. I mean, to be something that was parodied often.
I don't know. I feel like they did, like, Valley Girl the movie, and that was based on, like, one person, and then we're just like, yeah, I guess this is a thing.
Yeah. I mean, but it was so prevalent in 80s culture, just that voice that, oh, my God. Well, and it even stemmed into 90s. I mean, you get up to Clueless, and they're doing the same thing, you know? As if, oh, gag me with a spoon.
But just these are, especially because it's about young people, these are always the things I question in movies. Because you know that these are written by old fucks who are looking at young people derisively and condescendingly. And so that's, I think this is more just what old people thought young people sounded like because they hate them. Like, I don't think this was ever a real thing.
Well, and I mean, you see that to this day, too, you know. Jokes about millennials and, you know, not all millennials are, you know, always on Instagram and taking pictures of their breakfast, but some are, and that's all, you know, the old people see, so that's what they mock.
Because, like, I'm imagining, like, the people that were supposedly like this back then have now grown up and are adults. Have they grown out of that? Do they talk normal now, or do they still talk like that, or do they look back and go, like, oh, remember when I talked like a fucking retard? No, I just don't think they were ever real.
That would be a funny sketch. To bring back Denny Dillon and Gail Mathias as like 60-year-old ladies, and they're going, oh, as if. Oh, I got my hip replacement to the max last week.
You know, they would never do it with them, but they might do it with the 90s equivalent with Sandler and Spade and, well, obviously you couldn't do Farley now, but, you know, bring them back.
Where the Gap girls are today?
Yeah. They can't work because they closed the Gap because of coronavirus.
They did that. Well, they didn't do that. But they did do a Where Are They Now? I think it was the 25th anniversary season. They did a Where Are They Now of Hans and Franz, where they brought back Kevin Nealon and Dana Carvey as like older versions of Hans and Franz and caught up with them. And I always wanted them to do more of that. Like, why the hell not? Like, you know, what's the fucking Richmeister doing these days?
But I got nothing for Valley Girls, no.
This is a recurring character for Gail Mathias, the reason we're watching this episode.
Is it really?
Yeah, I believe this is the third time she's done it.
Oh, my God.
And I never liked any of them.
That's just sad.
It's a sketch based on a character. It's a character-based sketch. You got your Valley Girl character. You put her in the mall, and boys try to hit on her. But, yeah, it is boring to the max.
The Rocket Report,
which is very much better than the last one we saw in the Malcolm McDowell episode.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, Charles Rocket is giving a report on Santa and how magical he is and what he's doing up at the North Pole. But while he's saying all of that stuff, we see a drunken mall Santa running around New York City, smoking weed, pulling shit out of the garbage cans, accosting women.
Which I believe it's Charles Rocket in that suit as well.
I think so.
And I have a question about this sketch, because the premise overall of the Rocket Report is it's real people. So is that a real woman that he accosted on the street, or was that an actress? Was that real pot that he smoked?
Oh, I don't know.
Because this is the guy that said fuck on the air. Do you think he'd like go like, hey, let's get one over on the fucking censors and smoke real pot on the air? Because they'll never know.
Yeah, who would know? Well, and drug humor was huge around this time. That was huge in the first 5 seasons of SNL. They were always making, you know, sick sketches about smoking weed and shit. And like, what was the joke in Weekend Update where he just says, yeah, Rupert Murdoch is on Quaaludes, and then the audience cheers like it's the greatest fucking thing they've ever heard.
It's weird that people knew who Rupert Murdoch was even back then. That's just like, because we know him now for obvious reasons, but...
Right. Well, he was a shit back then. Yeah, he ran the New York Post, which was basically just, you know, salacious headlines and shit.
Mm.
Like, you know, fucking not real journalism at all.
So he's always been a piece of shit.
Oh, yeah. The New York Post was mocked mercilessly because it was always just headlines of sensationalism tabloid shit. Mm.
But no, I appreciated this bit for what it was, because there was a structure to it. There was juxtaposition between what was being said and what was being done. It made sense. I understood. I could feel the writing of it. That's the thing. So many of these sketches, like, I know they're not improv, but you could have fooled me just with how messy they are.
Yeah. Speaking of tightly structured, I take it you did not enjoy Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie.
Well, first off, I barely know who Woody Guthrie is.
I don't either.
And I did not get this at all. I didn't. I made me want to kill myself. This is fucking horrible.
By the time I got what they were doing, it was like too late, because they launch right into it. Basically, Bob Dylan shows up to Woody Guthrie's hospital bed. Woody Guthrie was a folk singer who David Carradine played in the film Bound for Glory.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So David Carradine is like reprising a role he played in a movie. And then that's Patrick Weathers as Bob Dylan. This is like the only thing Patrick Weathers ever did on the show.
Didn't we have an episode where we watched a thing precisely because of him?
He is the reason we watched the Malcolm McDowell episode.
Fuck Patrick Weathers.
But he's not even in that episode. We just picked a random episode from season 6 that didn't even include him. But yeah, he was a featured player. This was like basically his only sketch he was ever on. He was like a background extra for everything else he was ever in. But his Bob Dylan is passable.
Oh no, if this had been a sketch that was worth a damn, I would say, yeah, he would have been good.
But basically, Bob Dylan's visiting Woody Guthrie, and Woody Guthrie keeps saying, like, pearls of wisdom, and all of his pearls of wisdom are Bob Dylan lyrics.
What are you doing, writing a book?
Don't mind me, Woody, just keep on talking.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm just blowing in the wind these days. Hell, I feel like I'm a knocking on heaven's door. But I don't know, I just keep hoping I shall be released. It was like I was saying to Mick Jagger the other day, I can't get no satisfaction. I wouldn't know him. He's a complete unknown. He's like a rolling stone.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I'm a complete unknown, no direction home.
Like a rolling stone?
Yeah.
So I think what they're going for is Bob Dylan is, you know, was stealing all of his songs from things Woody Guthrie said.
Oh, okay. I mean, I got the references, or at least some of them, but enough of them to understand the bit. But I didn't pick up on that being the critique. Because was that a thing? Did they think he was just a ripoff of Woody Guthrie?
That I don't know. But, like, he's writing down everything Woody Guthrie says. And even at the end, he's like, hey, can I hang out here in case he says some stuff in his sleep? And he just keeps writing down lyrics. Because everything Woody Guthrie is saying is like, well, everybody must get stoned. And that's a Bob Dylan lyric.
Yeah.
But yeah, they launch right into that. That's like the first line Woody Guthrie says is a Bob Dylan song. And then I didn't know that was the bit until like halfway through the sketch. And I'm like, oh, I get what they're doing. Oh, I still don't like it. So yeah, this is where I turned the episode off and I was like, fuck this. I'm bored. I'm going to do something else. And then this afternoon, I kicked back into gear with the Dallas home game.
Which... it's short enough that I'm like, okay, I'll give it to them, fine. And Denny Dillon gets slapped. I kind of laughed at that.
A typical evening at home, not much fun, is it? But not anymore. You've seen the TV show. Now you can play the home version of Dallas. You'll get hats, booze, wigs, and a cheap handgun. Everything you need to play Dallas at home. Now let's see that scene again.
The problem for me is that's not how home games work. They're board games. They're not LARPing experiences where you wear a wig and you just pretend to play the thing in the show. That's so fucking dumb.
I know, but that's the joke. I thought that was funny. The Dallas home game is basically just a cowboy hat, two wigs, a bottle of booze, and a gun. And then you can just play Dallas at home.
I mean, I liked that it was literally the exact same thing, and sort of the critique of, like, this is just how trashy your life is, and we put it on TV. I liked that as a concept, but it just, I don't know, that took me out of it a little bit.
Yeah, I like that hidden joke, too, is that, like, these people are already pieces of shit. Just because you put them on TV and give them a cowboy hat doesn't make them less pieces of shit.
Yeah, it doesn't glamorize it at all.
And then we get a Mr. Bill Christmas special, which is a holdover from the season before. What are your feelings of Mr. Bill?
You know, I remember liking Mr. Bill as a kid. I remember seeing it and liking it, maybe just because it was claymation and it was like, maybe as a kid, like, oh, this claymation thing getting destroyed was funny. This was like fucking slow death to me. This, yeah. I did not get why this was. I mean, it feels like edgy relative to everything else, like for its time, but it seems so quaint now.
Yes, I don't think it's aged well at all. But at the time, this was just like new and innovative and like something weird. Like you didn't see something like this on TV. So it was just new and kind of crazy. But yeah, now it just looks kind of like stupid, like something stupid that someone put together in their house. And you're like, why was this on television?
It feels like there are a million unfunny YouTubers that do shit like this. Where it's like cruelty just like substituting for humor. Like we're just going to be assholes and isn't that funny?
Yeah, but like I said, you got to put that into context. At the time, this was something that nothing like this had ever been on TV before.
Yeah. No,
but
I
now
get it.
See this shit all the time.
No, I get it. I get why it was popular and I would say it's probably one of the less shitty things in the episode relative to say Valley Girls, but you know, still it's just meh.
Yeah. It's just passable fun, but it looks very like crappy, cheap and homemade, and that's the point. And like I said, that stuff like this wasn't on, you know, because home video wasn't prevalent. So, you know, not everyone had a cell phone that they could make a stupid short video with at their house.
I've seen homemade Lego videos on people's phones that are better than this, you know?
Yeah. Well, now, yes. But at the time, do-it-yourself filmmaking was like not a thing. You know?
Yeah.
There wasn't a YouTube where everybody could make a fucking movie in a day.
Well, that's, I've noticed that with all the short films that, other than, I guess, even the Rocket Report, but like, I'm thinking of the Cowboy one, like, they feel like, do-it-yourself, like, let's just make a shitty movie in our garage, but of the time when they didn't have the technology to actually make it good.
Yeah, exactly. They do look very, very shitty. So after that, we get Kung Fu Christmas, which has my favorite line of the episode, Bruce Lee is back, and this time he's black.
This time he's joined forces with the 20th century master of martial arts. Bruce Lee is back, but this time he's black. Together they must face the toughest criminal force ever known.
No, I did laugh at that. This one I almost thought like should have been more of a real sketch. It feels like it wasn't. Like it was just kind of like a throwaway.
Oh yeah, it makes, once the sketch gets going, it's over. Because it's David Carradine as Kane from Kung Fu, and then Eddie Murphy pops up as Bruce Lee, and then they get to a spot where they jump on a table with a bunch of people in Santa outfits, and you think they're going to like kick some Santa ass, but then it just ends. It's like, see Kung Fu Christmas this Christmas in theaters.
Especially because like, I feel like you need to pick one Kung Fu sketch. Keep the welfare one, but cut Kung Fu out of it because it doesn't make sense. And then cut the fucking fashion one altogether because it sucks. Just expand this one into its own sketch and you got your Kung Fu sketch.
Oh, yeah. I would love to see 2 or 3 minutes of Eddie Murphy as a black Bruce Lee kicking some Santa Claus ass.
You can bring in like Frosty the Snowman, all the different characters like they would do today, you know?
Yeah. Do you think this was what inspired Jingle All the Way?
Was that Jingle All? Yeah, that was Jingle All the Way with all the Santas at the
end.
Where
all the Santas getting a big Santa fight.
Which we watched for.
Who the fuck was in that?
I believe it was Jim
Phil
Belushi.
Hartman.
Was
that's
it Phil
right.
Hartman?
Or Chris? No, I think it was Chris Parnell. Chris Parnell's in Jingle All the Way.
Because I just remember Jim Belushi, who we've now, I think, or at least I've come around on as far as an SNL performer. I think we were still mocking him at that point.
Oh my God, I have so come around on Jim Belushi. Just out of coincidence, I started watching season 9 for my blog recaps, and that was Jim Belushi's first season. And he comes out of the gate with just some hilarious shit, and I was like, "Fucking Jim Belushi was really funny."
I think he's the Piscopo of that era.
Yeah, I was like, I've been underrating this guy for years. I mean, no, I guess maybe I haven't. He sucks a lot.
Well, I don't think he cares a lot. I think you get the impression he cares more with SNL than he does for like According to Jim.
Oh yeah, but no, he had some good shit on there. But yeah, I mean, he's had some bad shit in his career too. But I mean, we watched Real Men. I thought he was fun in that.
Oh yeah. So I think that gets us to Weekend Update.
Yeah, which I was dreading when it started, but this one was paced real well. It was like three jokes, desk piece. Three jokes, desk piece. We didn't have to sit with Charlie Rocket for like more than 35 seconds at a time.
And he seemed more comfortable with it. He wasn't looking down at his notes every time. He wasn't, you know, fumbling and stumbling and correcting himself weirdly.
Yeah. And some of the jokes were good. I liked the joke about the doctor who started a diet. Who was 15 pounds overweight at the time of his death.
According to physicians, the late Dr. Tarnauer, creator of the Scarsdale diet, was in fact 15 pounds overweight at the time of his death. However, since his death, Dr. Tarnauer has lost 67 pounds, thus vindicating his now famous diet.
And I got to talk about, it was Gail Mathias, right? The desk piece?
No, this is Ann Risley.
Ann Risley. Okay, I mixed them up because they're, who cares about right. them? But just the like the I just have dead animals and lard as my note.
Yeah. I liked this in concept, but man, Ann Risley cannot nail a joke.
No, if this had been the Gilbert Gottfried character from the episode 2 where he was like the weird doctor guy, I think it probably would have worked better.
Yeah, basically the whole she's giving Christmas tips, but all her tips involve lard in a plastic bag.
Now let's move on to the presents. Live animals gift wrapped and sitting beneath the tree for several days can strike a note of despair when unwrapped by excited children. Instead, level with the kids a few days in advance. Tell them that the present they are getting might be dead. Now, a sturdier gift idea might be lard wrapped in a plastic bag. One last reminder, Christmas trees can catch fire easily, especially if, like me, you're using last year's tree. So be very cautious about what kind of ornaments you use, particularly if you're planning to decorate the tree with lard wrapped in plastic bags.
Which is a funny idea. I like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, when it's coming out of her mouth, I'm like, ooh, I wish someone who was funny was saying this. But still, the joke's funny enough that I'm at least smiling.
And that's the weird thing. Like, you think... It's weird that anybody that gets on SNL that's actually like a full cast member and then doesn't go anywhere at all. Like I get like maybe some of them like Sherry O'Terry doesn't have the biggest career relative to somebody else, but you at least remember her. The fact that like you could literally like if somebody says Ann Risley and they go, who the hell is that? And that's the typical reaction. But then you watch this episode and you go, oh, that's why nobody fucking remembers Ann Risley, because she was fucking terrible.
Oh yeah, she was terrible. She is
no wonder she had no career.
Yeah, she is definitely in the bottom tier of SNL cast members of all time. If I were to make a list ranking every single SNL cast member, she would be down near the bottom. But I don't think she was a comedian. I think she was just an actress they hired. Which is part of the reason why this season is a huge failure. They didn't go after like funny people like they did in the original. You know, they got people from Second City. You know, they got fucking Charlie Rocket, a fucking weatherman.
Which I stand by my theory. I think some of those groups like Second City probably blackballed him after he left.
But yeah, I don't think Ann Risley was a comedian. I think she was just an actress they hired.
And it doesn't feel like they gel as a cast. Like, it doesn't feel like they like each other. Like, you watch even like Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry in the cheerleader sketch. You maybe don't like that sketch, but you feel like they're having fun with it. And like when they were rehearsing it, like they were probably laughing. You know, they were probably into it. Yeah, I don't feel like any of these people are into it.
Yeah, they definitely have a chemistry together. Yeah, these people, they just nobody gelled in this cast. And that's why it was canceled after 12 episodes.
Well, okay, after this, I don't know if you have more to say about Weekend Update.
No, I don't. You want to talk about Pirates of Penzance?
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah.
Not at all.
It's interesting. But if you're not familiar with the musical, The Pirates of Penzance, this musical makes no fucking sense. It's about pirates and cops and like ladies in waiting, and then they all get together on a boat and then they all just have a big fucking party. Like, that's the plot of Pirates of Penzance, and then they sing songs. It makes no sense. So when you're seeing three songs taken completely out of context from a musical that already makes little sense, yeah, this shit made no fucking sense.
I mean, the timing is obviously off, but like, just imagine if they did this today with like fucking Cats. Like, they had the cast of Cats come in and sing Jellicle songs for Jellicle cats.
See, I would love that. I said, like, you know, what if Hamilton was on there? Or, like, the cast of, like, fucking Mean Girls or whatever Broadway show's going on. If they were the musical guest on SNL, that'd be really fun. I mean, if when you watch the Tonys, I don't know if you watch the Tonys.
When you watch the Tonys. I fucking have never watched a goddamn episode of the Tonys in my life.
I like watching the Tonys because, you know, I don't get to see a lot of Broadway shows. Because I don't live in New York City. But yeah, you watch the Tonys and then, you know, they perform and it's like, oh yeah, that's what Broadway's like. Which I guess is, you know, weird that I'm saying that here after watching the Pirates of Penzance.
Oh my God, it sucks so much.
So that's what Broadway was like in 1980.
I got a minute in and I skipped it and it was like 6 minutes long easily.
Oh yeah, it's long because it's a medley of like three songs from the show.
And then they come back at the end for the fucking caroling shit. And I'm
yeah,
like, Jesus
they sing some Christmas carols.
Oh.
All right, but yeah, enough of the Pirates of Penzance. Heroin in Harlem is our next sketch.
This place the most?
Well, it does have a certain charm.
Well, I figure if we're going to do heroin, we might as well do it upright. I mean, after all, everybody's doing it at all the chic parties. And...
but we're doing it in Harlem.
I wonder if this is the same place where the Kennedy kids get theirs.
Oh, I don't know about this heroin business. Aren't you afraid it will lead to harder stuff?
Oh, come on, Peter. Don't poop on the party. Jeez. I mean, you're probably the kind of guy who worries about dirty needles. Loosen up, huh?
Why don't we just do cocaine?
Oh, cocaine is so last year. Cocaine is like quiche. Heroin is like sushi.
Which, this could have been my favorite sketch of the night if it had been built up a little bit. I liked the idea of it.
I did too. And I mean, it's not the funniest thing in the world, but I enjoyed watching it. It didn't bore me at all.
No, and in fact, you know, in retrospect, it actually might be my favorite sketch of the episode because it doesn't, like, I liked the premise of the, we'll get to the welfare sketch, but it was muddled for another reason. But this, at least it was one idea. But then I thought the end where it turns out he's a cop kind of was a cop out, ironically enough.
But at least it was an ending.
But I thought it was funny that it's just these like shitty white people trying to get heroin in Harlem and the guy's putting a knife to her throat and she's just like, oh, it's the local flavor. I liked that stuff.
Yeah, these rich white assholes are trying to buy heroin basically just because it's chic, you know, and something to do. And so they go into Harlem to buy some. And I liked Joe Piscopo as a white out of touch guy. Like, hey, look, I'm not trying to haggle a deal. How much is the heroin? He played a good white asshole. And then they buy some heroin from Eddie Murphy. He turns out to be an undercover cop and arrests them. But yeah, no, I like the concept of these white people just getting a kick out of, you know, going to the slums to buy their drugs.
And when the sketch first started, I wrote in my notes, oh, this is going to be racist. And arguably you can say it was, but I mean, the joke was on the white people. But even so, this is what I think, to the extent that they want to be edgy and use kind of racially centric humor, this is where it can work, where, like, I get the point of it. I get what they're trying to say. It's not just they're saying the N-word just to be shocking. I don't know. This feels like it justifies itself on that level.
Yeah, and like you said, the joke is that these white people are terrible, terrible people.
Yeah.
I did like Ann Risley's line of, is this heroin all natural? Because I don't put anything unnatural in my body.
No, I liked these characters. I felt like you could transplant these characters almost as a recurring bit, just getting into stupid situations because they're just, you know, urbane hipsters or whatever you called a hipster back then.
Oh yeah, like maybe they go into a brothel and they're trying to get like a Korean love slave.
Why does it have to be Korean, man?
I don't know. I was trying to keep with the racist angle of the times.
Well, first, it's not like they had an Asian actress to fucking play a Korean.
That's never stopped them before.
Well, we're talking about the episode where Eddie Murphy plays Bruce Lee.
Billy Crystal's probably not doing anything in 1980. He could play the young Korean prostitute.
Oh. Only if he plays him as Dr. Hang-Yes-Nor from The Killing Fields.
Oh, you, me love you long time.
Oh, man.
So Billy Crystal's racist, if you haven't heard our other podcasts.
Every fucking episode of this show is racially uncomfortable at best, racist at worst.
Yeah. And you wonder, like, I mean, I'm guessing people probably didn't think of that at the time. It was just par for the course. So, you know, I kind of wonder, like, you know, 20 years from now, what's going to be dated from current SNL, like the current era? Is there going to be something where we go like, oh, Kate McKinnon shouldn't have been doing that, you know?
I feel like, because like who's the Asian guy they cast, the new guy?
Bowen Yang.
I feel like every time I've seen him on the show, it has been a really offensive Asian stereotype.
Yeah, I feel that way too.
He's never just been like a guy who happens to be Asian. He's always like Kim Jong-il or something.
The joke of his character is usually that he's Asian, or I mean, that's the crutch of his character. He very rarely will just play a guy who happens to be Asian, you know, like that's not the whole point of it. But like, so yeah, I wonder if shit like that, they're going to be like, why didn't they just let him play guys? Like, why does every character he play have to be Asian?
Well, because that's the one thing. I think we do have to get away from what I consider to be tokenism, where it's just like, we have to put this guy in for that. Because I don't think people are ready for it. Like, we got to get to a point where we can maybe skip that and then get to the thing where it's like, yeah, we cast this guy, it was Asian, and who cares? It didn't matter. Like, we're still in that phase where it's like, well, we got an Asian guy. We got to have him. We got to play da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da behind him, right? Like, I feel like we're expecting too much of the same writers that it was always like they never thought to cast black people or Asian people to now suddenly have to cast them and write them in a way that isn't horrible.
Right.
Like, it's still the same shitty white racist writers, you know?
Yeah. Well, you should find a part for Bowen to play in this sketch. Oh, okay. Hey, do we still have that gong in prop storage? Because I just got an idea.
Do we still have the outfit that Mike Myers wore in that sketch years ago? Because now it won't be racist because he's really Asian. No, I feel like there's definitely room to improve.
Yeah. Like I said, I wonder if in 20 years we'll look back at that and go like, God damn it, man. What the fuck was wrong with SNL in 2020?
I don't know. After whatever it is, 35, 40 years, how are we looking back on the Virgin Search sketch?
This needed some setup. I was lost. I had no idea who these people were. I did not know what was going on in this sketch.
Well, they're casting for SNL, right?
Yes, but I don't think that, unless I missed it, I don't think that was clear in the opening.
Not cool it, not cool it. Here she is. Sophisticated, yet naive.
Naive. Naive.
Typical, yet unique in a girl next door kind of way.
Perfect, perfect, perfect.
Your job, team, go out and find her.
Exactly. No problem.
One other thing. She's got to be a virgin.
A virgin?
If you do this today, I mean, you wouldn't do it today, but you'd have Lorne Michaels playing himself doing that.
Right.
Saying, find me the next cast member and make sure she's a virgin. In fact, I even think that might work just how absurd it is, you know? But it doesn't work here because, yeah, you don't understand that that's what's happening.
Yeah, they didn't set it up properly. And actually, in I think the episode before this, episode 4, they had a similar short film with Gilbert Gottfried, where Gilbert Gottfried set it up and he's like, hey, a lot of people wonder how I got cast on the show. Well, here's a movie about it. And then they threw to the movie and it was basically Gilbert Gottfried, you know, how he got cast on SNL. So I wonder if this was a continuation of that with Gail Mathias. They never did it again, as far as I know, remember.
Even independent of the premise, because when it first starts, I get it. I mean, I don't get it, but I mean, once they're going to all these people and like, and are you a virgin? I kind of gleaned what was going on. But then they introduced Gail Mathias's character, and she's a virgin because she wants to fuck Carl Sagan.
She's saving herself for Carl Sagan.
What the fuck was that? What was that?
I have no idea. But I also don't know why Carl Sagan was referenced again. Because did you catch the Carl Sagan reference in the KFC sketch?
He's the Carl Sagan of chicken, yeah.
They call Colonel Sanders the Carl Sagan of chicken. Why is Carl Sagan the go-to reference?
That's why I'm assuming it has to be something just I'm not – I mean, I know who Carl Sagan is, but maybe there's some context that I'm just not understanding.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
Excuse me. Excuse me, ma'am. Hey, You got like special people that come in here, like say movie stars or celebrities or like TV physicists. You got those in here? You got like, okay. So Carl Sagan. Don't look at me like that. I'm not on drugs or something, man. I don't do drugs. I don't do no booze. I don't even do sex, man. I don't even do sex. No, what? Talk to me. Hey, what? What? You know, you're probably thinking why I don't even do sex, right?
Did you say you're a virgin?
That's right. I'm saving myself for Carl Sagan.
A virgin?
I'm saving myself for Carl Sagan. That's right.
We found a virgin.
But anyway, this virgin search sketch, these three executives, they're looking for a new cast member for SNL. The boss specifically says you need to find a virgin. So they go around the world trying to find a virgin. All of these are played by Gail Mathias. They find a cheerleader. They ask her if she's a virgin. She says, well, kinda. And then they leave. They find, what's the second one? Oh, the young girl in Paris. And she says, oh no, Monsieur Polanski. So that's kind of an edgy joke.
Which, I was going to ask that. When was this relative to the Polanski rape thing?
It would have been right around the time. I think
so. Like, was this a reference to that? Or just a reference to him being a snooty director? Because I know he was, prior to this, he already had a reputation for, like, dating young ingenues and stuff. So I don't know. But was it actually a reference to the rape or just that?
Oh, you think this was before the rape?
I don't remember when that was.
Oh, I would have thought it would have had to have been after or post-rape. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't.
I don't know. It seems really dark if it was post-rape. But, I mean, they did some dark shit.
Yeah, well, because it's also a French girl, and he, you know, fled to France afterwards. So that's what I thought the joke was.
But he directed in France a lot before that. So, I mean, he was known for being in there.
All right. Well, if this sketch predates Roman Polanski raping an underage girl, then this is the most prescient SNL sketch I've ever seen.
I'm going to look it up after we record, because, yeah, I'm interested to know that. Yeah. And then a nun, that was...
The nun who got fucked by Father Guido Sarducci. That made me laugh. They go up to a nun and they're like, oh, and just sign this, just admitting that you're a virgin. And she goes, oh, damn you, Father Sarducci.
Which was, Father Guido Sarducci, was that a thing at this time?
Yeah, he was from the original era.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if, like, that might have been a reference to a real thing that I just didn't know about, and then they made Father Guido Sarducci based on that.
Oh, no.
I thought he was later on.
No, Father Guido Sarducci was a recurring character in the first five seasons. Yeah, they're referencing that. And then they find Gail Mathias in a bar. She's asking if anyone's seen Carl Sagan, because that's who she's saving herself for. So they're like, oh, a virgin, and then they hire her. That's the end of it. But yeah, there's no setup for this. I was lost for most of it.
You think that's the end of this sketch? Because I think it ends with implied rape. Is
what?
That not
Did
at
I
the
miss
end
that?
When she's like, I'm saving myself. She's sitting in front of the boss and he's like, yeah, you're hired. And then he gets out of his chair and he walks over to her. And then he cuts to like the building, which is very penile. It's very phallic. And then she's like, and that's how I made it in Hollywood. I think the implication is he wanted a virgin so he could deflower them.
Oh, I did not get that.
I thought it was like a Weinstein thing. I thought that was the joke.
Oh, I mean, I guess it wasn't explicit, but it could have been.
Oh, no. But like, because he like walks over to her and she's like looking up at him. And then you cut to like they literally like pan down the penis shaped building. I'm just like, I think this is what's going on.
Oh, OK. Well, yeah, if that was it, that's not what I got from it, but could have been.
And
speaking of,
I have so many
messages,
more fucking things. How long is this fucking episode? I have like four more lines here.
I know. Well, there's a lot of short sketches. I mean, what are the fucking Bruce
Lee
is back in black and Dallas at home. All those are really short.
Copenhagen and Happy Days.
But yeah, speaking of mixed messages, did you understand this little commercial,
no.
David Carradine?
At this point, my only note is okay, and then my next one for the Morning Colonel Sanders sketch is just ugh. Like I've stopped at this point.
Well, I watched this back a second time. It's David Carradine, and he's like, I'm a musician, and most musicians smoke, but not me. I dip. And that's why I use, and I replayed it back, he says Copenhagen the first time. So that's why I was confused, because Copenhagen is a brand of chewing tobacco.
You know, I love music. I love to listen to it. I love to play it.
And most of the time, you know, when the music cooks, the musicians smoke. But not me. No, sir. Because, like a lot of my friends, I use the smokeless hit, Copenhagen. Just take a pinch or two of that good-feeling Mendocino-flavored Copenhagen between your cheek and gum.
I got it by the end, and maybe just in my head, like, retrospectively, I forgot that. But, yeah, that I guess you wouldn't understand it.
Yeah, so
at all.
When this sketch started, he's like, that's why I grab Copenhagen. And I'm like, oh, this is just a commercial for Copenhagen? And because he doesn't say smoke weed, he says most musicians smoke. So my mind went to cigarettes first. And then he says Copenhagen. I was like, oh, yeah, chewing tobacco for people who don't smoke. But it's actually Dopenhagen. He just fucked up the line because he drank too much. This is a commercial for chewable marijuana.
I also didn't know that Copenhagen was a brand of chew. I got it with the Happy Days reference. I said, oh, he's chewing pot. I didn't understand. I mean, it still wasn't funny, but at least I got it by the end.
Oh, no. But yeah, also, David Carradine is just stumbly bumbling all over his fucking lines in this sketch.
I was
lost.
And that's the thing. When I say I thought he was more nervous than drunk, I don't doubt for a second he was drunk. He was drunk on the set of a lot of movies. I'm sure he was drunk on the set of SNL. It feels as much of him just being uncomfortable in a live scenario than it does him drink. Maybe he was drinking more because of that, because he just didn't feel in his element.
Yeah. All right, so now we go to the Kentucky Fried Chicken sketch, which might be my favorite of the episode.
Really? This I could not get into. I guess Colonel Sanders, feels weird that he lived this long, but I guess he must have recently died at this point.
Yeah, I looked it up. He died 4 days before this episode aired.
Oh, geez.
This is like, he is freshly dead for this sketch. And this sketch is just David Carradine, Denny Dillon, and Eddie Murphy eating buckets of chicken, talking about how much they missed Colonel Sanders and how sad they are that he died.
Hey, what's the matter, baby? Come on, what's the matter?
Oh, this chicken just doesn't taste the same since the Colonel died.
Hey, wow, man, you're really serious about your chicken, ain't you, baby?
Oh, chicken's my whole life.
Yeah.
I love the Colonel for 25 years. I'll never lick my fingers again.
I can dig it. He was the Carl Sagan of chicken.
And that's it. That's the whole sketch. But I liked it because I thought this was the only sketch David Carradine worked for me in, unless his character is not supposed to be like a drunk, homeless derelict. But if his character is supposed to be a drunk, homeless derelict, he is playing that to a T.
The thing that struck me with this sketch, and maybe you didn't feel this at all, but I felt it was kind of mean. I felt like it was like making fun of poor people. I felt like this was like rich Saturday Night Live writers, like hip New Yorkers who would never eat at KFC, talking, because I'm sure there were people that like were interviewed, like, yeah, I'm really sad that the Colonel died because I love his fried chicken. And this was them watching those interviews on the news and going like, who would fucking mourn a chicken, some fast food chicken guy? Fucking these dumb rubes. I felt like that was the impetus for the sketch.
And maybe. But yeah, because they are all like, they're all very dumb.
Exactly. And I literally had KFC like this week.
So you were personally offended.
Well, because in the Corona apocalypse, I like to go out at least once a week to get fast food just for a sense of normalcy, you know, through the drive-thru. So yeah, that was my selection this week. It's like, fuck you.
No pandemic's going to stop me from my bucket of chicken.
You know the weirdest fucking one? I went to Chick-fil-A. Which was probably dangerous because I imagine a lot of people that go to Chick-fil-A aren't heeding the social distancing guidelines.
Oh, no. They're like, oh, Jesus will save us. Let's make some chicken. Did you wash your hands before you made that chicken? I prayed the germs away.
But no, the employees are taking it very seriously. It's all drive through and stuff. But they have, you know, they have masks now, which is good. But they actually made their own branded masks. You know, they have the cow. So, like, their masks have, like, the cow blotches on.
Right? Oh,
like the
geez.
Black cow spots. Like they went out of their way to like, so when I'm looking him in the face and going like, oh, what a grim reminder of what we're all going through. But eat more chicken.
Oh God, that is gross that they manufactured fucking Chick-fil-A masks.
When there are people that literally can't buy them, they're like, we're going to take some extra time to put our fucking logo and shit on it.
All right. So anyway, Ben was offended by the Kentucky Fried Chicken. Ben was eating a big bucket of chicken. threw it down in disgust.
I was eating a very reasonable three-piece Nashville hot tender meal. It wasn't a giant bucket of chicken. I'm not a glutton.
And he just threw his bones at the screen and said, "How dare you?"
It's boneless. I eat the whole thing. Well, I don't eat the biscuit, but I'm not a fucking animal.
But I liked some of the lines in here. I liked when Eddie came in and said, "Give me some skin," and then David Carradine hands him some chicken skin. I thought that was funny. And then when they asked, where were you when he died? Where were you when the colonel died? I was buying some chicken. I was eating some chicken. I was sleeping with a chicken.
So, where was y'all when the colonel died?
Oh, well, I was buying chicken, as a matter of fact. What were you doing?
Oh, I was eating chicken. What were you doing, Dave?
I was sleeping with a chicken. I can't get enough of this stuff.
Yeah, that was all good stuff. It's not, again, not laugh out loud hilarious, but I did like the performances in this one, and I thought it was nice and cute.
It's definitely one of the more realized and better prepared sketches. It doesn't feel like they're winging it, no chicken pun intended, like they are in some of the other ones.
Oh, and then we get Bill Irwin as the dancing man. I don't know. There's
like
a
this.
Lot to talk about that. I really like this, but it's very physical, so it's going to be hard to describe. But if you know Bill Irwin, he's a famous mime, clown, commedia dell'arte, or whatever you call that. A very physical comedian, and he plays a hungover man, and every time he hears Shake Your Groove thing, he compulsively dances.
This felt like a 48-hour film festival short, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, just like a kind of cute little do-it-yourself thing. Like, in the way that the other do-it-yourself pre-film bits always seem like really off-putting, this felt like, oh, they actually got one right.
Yeah, and Bill Irwin's fantastic. I loved when he was dancing down the stairs. Like, that was incredible. Like, he falls down the stairs, but he's still dancing while he's falling down the stairs.
Yeah.
I also liked how they made Shake Your Groove thing, Ben's favorite word, diegetic to the story.
It's a perfectly appropriate word in certain circumstances.
No,
fuck
I
you.
Know. But every time you say it on the podcast, you're always like, diegetic. You always like say like, aha. I know.
I feel like you're imagining that.
But anyway, so Shake Your Groove thing actually exists in the universe. It doesn't just play magically. So the ways it plays, it's like a guy rings his doorbell and he's just holding a big 80s boombox that's playing Shake Your Groove thing.
No, yeah. And then like the little music box plays it.
Yeah. He opens up a music box and he delicately opens it and it's Shake Your Groove Thing, Shake Your Groove Thing. And yeah, every time he hears that song, he just compulsively dances. And yeah, it's purely physical, but I would definitely recommend checking this one out if it's available on like YouTube. That was really fun.
Yeah, it's called The Dancing Man. I would say it's probably the best pre-film short we've watched so far for the show.
And now we're wrapping it up because the final thing of the night is Pirates of Penzance singing Christmas carols. But this is our last official sketch. The welfare office, and apparently you liked this way more than I did.
No, I didn't like it. This is two sketches that I would have liked had they been them that just themselves, but they combined them in a way that ruined both of them. Like, the idea that, yeah, Kung Fu is unemployed, of course he's on welfare. That's a funny that's a funny premise for a sketch. Or the darker, more cynical one of, it's the Reagan years, we're going to make you whore yourself out for your welfare. That's maybe not as brilliant or as funny, but that can work for me as a sketch, as, you know, making fun of Reagan. Put them together, it makes no fucking sense.
Yeah. Well, and then this was, again, hampered by just David Carradine not fucking knowing where he's supposed to go or what he's supposed to say. And I felt so bad for Yvonne Hudson because this is basically her first episode, too. She was actually an extra in the first couple years, but this is her first credited episode. And yes, has to share the screen with just David Carradine, who is like, I don't know what the fuck lines he's saying.
Now, the most important thing I will be giving you today are these black books, Ms. Robley, Mr. Kane.
There's nothing but phone numbers in here.
Those are job contacts, Ms.
Jobs? What kind of jobs?
Well, each one of those phone numbers is a consumer of personal services, what we call a CPS.
CPS? Well, what am I supposed to do?
Well, sessions will be arranged between you and the CPS where you provide intimacies in return for these stamps, which your CPS has purchased from this office.
These stamps, this black book, these intimacies, sounds like hanky-panky to me.
Well,
prostitution?
And you mentioned it at the beginning of the show that, like, the black woman, the one black woman on the cast has to be in this sketch where she's made to be a prostitute to get her welfare check. Not, I mean, beyond just is it racist or not, it's so uncomfortable that it's hard to laugh at the conceptual bit where it's like, because she's not playing it for comedy. She's playing it like, no, I need that money to feed my children and I got to fuck this guy.
That's definitely another problem with this sketch is, well, Yvonne Hudson was also not a comedian. She was just an actress that they hired. So, yeah, I don't think she's not playing this for laughs. When Denny Dillon is like, here's your little black book. And it's a list of numbers. You call those numbers, you fuck those guys, and then they pay you money. That's how you get your fucking food stamps. And then she's like, oh, okay.
But that's the thing. As dark as it is for that era, again, you know, in the Reagan world, I can see very liberal writers like going like, oh, yeah, that's what welfare is going to be. Well, you think of it now with Trump. They're you know, they're fucking making everybody get jobs and shit. It's like, you know, that's a real – not that real, but – That is an escalation of a real thing. So, like, I can feel where they're coming from.
Are you as curious as I am?
I seek water.
Hey, baby, I'm into that.
So, anyway, the David Carradine episode of SNL. What was your favorite sketch?
I'm gonna go ahead and say the heroin sketch. I think that was probably the most well realized.
Heroin Harlem. I'll go the Kentucky Fried Chicken.
That probably my second favorite, I would say. I mean,
like that.
Taking away my own personal insult from it, I would say it's probably the best realized after that.
And then what would be your worst least favorite sketch?
Oh, let's look at the fucking list. I mean, can I count the Pirates of Penzance?
You know, Pirates of Penzance was interesting.
No, I mean, it's got to be Valley Girls, right?
That would be mine, too. Vicky the Valley Girl. But even with that as the worst sketch, yeah, when we came away from the Malcolm McDowell episode, I was like,
I was in physical pain.
We got done watching that episode. I was like, I'm not going to fucking talk about this. There was nothing in this episode that made me like angry that I was watching it.
No, after Malcolm McDowell, like, we joke about it, but I was literally like, can we not podcast? Like, can we not do this anymore? Like, yeah. I was, for a second, I was like, I don't know what the point of this is. Yeah, this, I was like, yeah, there's enough to talk about, and yeah.
It was so bad. Yeah, this is probably one of the best episodes of the season. I mean, I would say
God.
Bill Murray. Well, it's a bad season. I mean, that's not a secret.
No, I know that, but like, just to say that this is in the upper echelon, to say this, if you had said this was a middling episode, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. The best fuck, or one of the best, Jesus.
Yeah, there's the Bill Murray episode, the last episode, is actually legitimately good. And then the episode hosted by Karen Black is pretty decent, like good. And then I would say this is probably the third best, and then all the other ones are just shit.
I think the next time we get a season sixer, I think we go for Bill Murray. Just, I want to see what that's like.
That's good. I think the only season sixer left on the spreadsheet is Denny Dillon still on there.
Well, there's some Denny Dillon movies. Remember, there's a...
It's true. What was it with Nick Nolte and Katharine Hepburn?
I can't remember the name of it, but it seemed interesting. And I have it. I found the movie.
Oh, it's like The Great McGillicuddy or something.
Something like that.
Yeah. So speaking of that, do you want to do a random number generator, or do you just want to pick a number between 24 and 51?
All right, I'll go ahead and pick 46.
46? Why don't you pick another number?
Okay, just out of curiosity, what is 46?
46 is Pamela Stevenson. So that means we're going to go back to the only season she was on, season 10. We can't just keep watching the same fucking seasons of SNL.
Because everybody else went on to better things and have movies. It's only these shitty seasons where nobody gave a shit.
I mean, we can look her up and see if she's in any.
Okay,
now,
okay. But... What was it?
35 is Tracy Morgan.
I feel like we can find a Tracy Morgan movie.
Tracy Morgan movie? What's Tracy Morgan in? All right.
I know he's in Cop Out. We can watch that.
Cop Out. I mean, there's some, there's probably some classic SNL episodes from his time. I'm pretty sure he's in the Tom Green episode, if you wanted to watch that.
I would be curious to watch that again. I remember watching that when it aired.
Just because, to do our due diligence, I am looking up Pamela Stevenson. Oh, that's right. She's in Ghosts Can Do It, but we looked for that and couldn't find it.
Okay, so that's not Ghosts Can't Do It, the one with Donald Trump in it.
No, we...
Is it a sequel? Did we look that up?
No, yeah, it's unrelated. It's about, like, a guy trying to fuck his dead wife or something.
Because Ghosts Can't Do It is about a wife trying to fuck her dead husband.
Yeah.
Those can't be unrelated movies.
We've looked at this before. We pulled Pamela Stevens' name out of the hat before and looked up Ghosts Can Do It.
One of the symptoms of coronavirus is just forgetfulness. Hey, is Tracy Morgan in Grown Ups 2? We haven't watched that yet.
Wait a minute. Doc, I can't remember the plot of Ghosts Can Do It. Oh, God. Let's get him the defibrillator. He's forgotten the plot of that movie. All right, so... I'm up for watching another episode of Saturday Night Live, but not from season 10 again. We've already done two episodes from season 10, so we're skipping Pamela Stevenson. Tracy Morgan, and I'll read off a couple titles I see. Half-Baked, Bamboozled, he's uncredited in that. How High?
I was going to mention Bamboozled is actually my favorite Spike Lee movie, but I've seen it enough, so it's probably not as far as discussion goes. Plus, it's very heavy in terms of, you know, racial politics and things.
Yeah, I don't think it would be a fun watch.
How High, I've never seen.
How High with Method Man and Redman. There's also the Adam Sandler remake of The Longest Yard, which I've never seen.
I'd rather watch How High.
That's really all. That David O. Russell movie that he disowned. He's in that.
Oh, Nailed or whatever. I think they changed the title of it.
They changed the title to Accidental Love.
I'd watch Accidental Love or How High. Either one of those I think is interesting.
How High? I could watch How High. Yeah, I've never seen that. I believe our good buddy SNL alum Finesse Mitchell is in that as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, then we should probably save it for Finesse Mitchell. No, I'm not.
Because I know we've talked about watching How High at one point. So someone else from SNL is in. Oh, Garrett Morris is in How High. You know who else is in How High?
Denitra Vance?
Nope. Our favorite convicted pedophile, Jeffrey Jones.
So wait, Jeffrey Jones, Finesse Mitchell, and Garrett Morris are all in both Who's Your Caddy and How High?
I don't see Finesse Mitchell on this cast list. But Garrett Morris and Tracy Morgan are definitely in How High. As is convicted pedophile Jeffrey Jones.
So at least Garrett Morris and Jeffrey Jones are both in those both movies. Because Garrett Morris was Who's Your Caddy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know else? You know who else is in How High?
Fucking. Who's the guy from that band that was in that movie?
What?
Who was the main guy in Who's Your Caddy? Wasn't it the guy from?
Fucking Big Boy.
Big Boy, yeah.
No,
is he in How High?
No, but of course, Hector Elizondo is in How High.
Wait, was How High directed by Gary Marshall?
Was this a Gary Marshall joint? No, it was not.
I mean, after Exit to Eden, you cannot surprise me with, and Gary Marshall directed this.
All right, Method Man, you pass the doobie to Red Man.
And then off screen, I'll yell some borscht belt humor.
You got Gary Marshall voiceover going, "Oh, this weed is kicking."
Oh, I'm so high right now.
right. So yeah, I like that. I like that as a plan. How High from 2001, Method Man and Red Man, featuring SNL alums Tracy Morgan and Garrett Morris, and a cavalcade of sex offenders. Wait, because Fred Willard's in it too.
Oh, that's right. No, Fred Willard wasn't a sex. I mean, he jerked off in the theater.
Yeah, he just whipped it out in a theater.
But I fully expect him to suck, just like every time Fred Willard shows up in a movie where we're like, we love him, right? Oh, no, it's epic movie.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds like a plan. So I think we're good for this week.
Yep. How All high right. next week? Until we see you again, get up
off the shed.
Good night. Good night. I don't know about you, but I'll be spending New Year's Eve at Art Fleming's snorting pulverine.